going from growing up with an identity as I'm an artist, I come from a family of artists, to going into the business world and being like, I'm producing a result. This result has nothing to do with my identity. Was a really powerful experience because it sort of, it made me realize that, you know, I'm not an artist. I'm not a search engine marketer. I'm not a XYZ. What I really am is just someone who tends to be more creative when they produce something.
This is the Cracking Creativity Podcast, episode number 43 with Max Makewell. Welcome to the Cracking Creativity Podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Chung, and I'm here to show you how creatives turn their ideas into action, create interesting projects, and build an engaged audience through shared passions. Now let's get creative. In this episode of the Cracking Creativity Podcast, I talked to Max Makewell, who is a New York City-based artist and muralist. He came courtesy of a mutual friend, Tyler Bell, who is also on the podcast. In it, Max talks about what it was like to go from being an artist to working at a startup to being an artist again. He also talks about owning your identity, making your way through obstacles, and building relationships as the core for marketing your art. Now, on to the episode. Welcome to another episode of Cracking Creativity. Today I'm on Max Makewell, and he is a New York City-based artist and muralist, and he was just recently featured in the Soho Gallery, Guy Hepner. Max, can you tell us a little bit more about yourself and how you got to where you are now?
Sure. Thanks for having me, first of all. So getting to where I am now, that's a good question. I started out from a family of artists, so had a really, really strong encouragement kind of growing up, and that turned into of working as a professional portrait artist for a few years. And then I took a little break, got into a business for a little while, and then I returned to art. I was sort of more fresh eyes and kind of very interested in making, you know, very creative, kind of out-of-the-box works of art. So using the techniques from portraiture, but really focused on how to make successful images that more people could kind of relate to.
Why did you take a break and what did you go do during that time?
So I focused on, I got really fascinated with why people, you know, like one image more so than another. And I started messing around with search engine marketing because it was sort of like a testing platform. And for me, it was sort of a miracle to see, you know, that you could change some words around and certain people would be more enticed to click on something than, let's say, its competing ad. So I got really focused on that, interested in it. And then I was also doing a bit of software engineering as well, which is sort of like, you know, building products that people can interact with on a daily basis. So those are the two major categories.
And you said you grew up with a family of artists. What did your family members do?
So my great-grandfather was a sculptor, and he would do war memorial sculptures in Budapest, Hungary. And then my grandfather, he was a sculptor as well, and he immigrated to the U.S. and continued doing sculpture. And then my mother was a painter. So sort of like a long line of, you know, I would say, encouragement growing up, working in these different traditional mediums.
In a family full of artists, what did you do as a child? Were you into the arts from the very beginning?
As a kid, I mean, I would go to my grandpa's house or studio every weekend and, you know, kind of like sit next to him, and he'd be like, welding these grasshoppers out of like old cash registers that used to be made out of metal. And I'd sort of be like, you know, holding solder for him, and he'd be adjusting these acetylene torches and things. So that was the sort of, one experience of growing up, kind of like learning how to weld, or, you know, another day it was working in wax. So it'd be like, you know, sitting over this pot of molten wax, building or just, you know, putting together sculptures of like an eagle head or a man with a top hat, or just all these different kind of figments of my imagination. I could sit there and kind of create. And my grandfather was a huge influence in just being that sort of supporting the creative side.
What can you remember? One of the first pieces that you made that made you think, "This is amazing."
let's see. I guess it's hard to say. Just because of sort of growing up in that environment, I never thought it was different. I thought it was, this is just what every family did, and so I only learned later on that, you know, certain families have different trades they love to have, and then certain families just kind of do all kinds of other cool stuff. So for me, it was never like a moment where I was like, oh, we're doing art now. It was more so just, you know, being creative, being productive, that served the mantra of the family. So I don't know, but like one of my favorite pieces early on was my dad let me loose in his, he had a manufacturing factory, and I would sort of like run through the different hallways, and they'd have all these drawers full of metal parts. And I'd go around collecting these different like bolts and kind of widgets and things like that. And I come back and I get this like Gorilla Glue and glue all the pieces together into like some robotic metal hand or something, you know? So to me, like that was like the greatest thing on earth, and I was super excited about it. It probably cost a good chunk of change because those were very specialized parts, but but my dad seemed to handle it in stride. So, so yeah.
Did you go to school for art, or did you just rely on what you learned through your family?
I'd say a little bit of both. When my grandfather passed, I was still pretty young. I think I was 14, and I immediately kind of was placed with some kind of private instruction in addition to what, you know, school offered. And so I had my sort of first mentor when I was 14, and that was a huge shift in what I thought was possible, and, you know, the kind of person or artist that I would grow into for the next 10 years. And I guess, you know, part of that was, you know, being a really strong influence. It's like I ended up going to art school and sort of like turning down like a rowing scholarship, and then just decide, you know, if I'm going to go for it, I'm going to go all the way, and I'm going to see, kind of carry it to the end and see what's out there. And I ended up going to one school down in Florida called Ringling. As Ringling College of Art and Design, and that was a great school. I guess once I finished 1 year there, then I was really focused on kind of finding like a stronger painting department. So I ended up going to transferring over to Art Center in Pasadena, and then Los Angeles, that is. And then after that, I actually ended up dropping out and studying privately with, you know, different artists and mentors for the next few years. So I would say the pattern was always finding someone who could draw and paint like way better than me, and then shadowing with them till I was, you know, 80% the way there, and then, you know, kind of continue doing that in different types of disciplines, I'd say.
Right. Yeah. Who were some of the mentors you studied under, and what did they teach you along your journey towards becoming a better artist?
Sure. So one of them, or my first mentor, who really kind of opened my eyes to what, you know, what these different schools had to offer, was Frank Porcu, and he's primarily an anatomist. So he would actually do cadaver dissections, and he had his own cadaver at Columbia Medical Center in New York. And you can imagine, how extreme that seems for most people who, are in the arts or even outside of the arts to study the body as a piece of architecture and go there and kind of understand how the different kind of like muscle groups interact and work together. And for me, it was just like endlessly fascinating as a kid and seems somewhat morbid to other people, but it was perfectly in line with, just understanding the secrets behind, the old masters and understanding sculpture and how that influences drawing. So for me, that was probably one of the single most fascinating instructors I studied with. And he also had a really strong philosophical bent. So he'd always be giving books as homework assignments, like, reading Socrates or Plato or Machiavelli and kind of like reading them and then like telling them what I read and giving me like poetry to memorize. And it's like just really very Renaissance, very romanticized kind of mentorship, I'd say. And then maybe another instructor actually who is, he's so infectious in his enthusiasm, and he was a master of a color. His name was Alex Schaefer. He was in Art Center in Pasadena. And he would break down color in a way that was so kind of like mathematical and understandable and consistent in a way that you could go from that and then you could, play jazz from understanding the scales really clearly. So he's someone who definitely opened up my eyes to cleaning up my understanding of color and then being able to kind of push it much further.
Cool. What did you do after learning under these teachers?
It was a sort of like a smooth transition from, I guess, being a student for what would be the equivalent of like undergrad and grad. So I guess it was 6 years of studying privately. And then I started to be a teacher assistant in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And then that turned into a little bit of like a teaching gig. And then there was a portion actually where the sort of all that being in Santa Fe, I ended up getting into stone carving as well. And that was, I would say, the very last portion of my training. And then commissions just started coming. So I had a portfolio that was very, very focused on figurative portraiture. And then people would just be like, hey, I would love if you could do a portrait, how much? And then that's sort of how that started.
And how long did you do portraits?
It's funny. I don't really have a hard date, but I guess it was a few years. It was just something that was pretty much always there from the beginning of working. And I'm trying to think like if there's a period of time where I actually have like a hard stop date, but people would request a portrait, let's say of their kid, and then they'd want the next child done, but that would be like a year later or 2 years later, depending on, how their children were stacked up in terms of birth date. So that's always just been something there.
And what kind of style did you use when creating those? Were they different depending on the person who was requesting them, or were you always creating them in a certain specific portrait style?
Yeah, style is a very interesting question, especially when your focus is on classical realism. So for me, studying with these different instructors was like trying on different style hats and kind of seeing if, I could let go of everything that had, everything I had kind of bringing with me, kind of like let go of that and just focus on what they were doing, kind of on their terms. So after a while of studying with so many different people and trying so many different styles, you've sort of become like styleless. And, it's like you can do something any way that it's required to be done in order to get the best, I'd say, illusion. And for me, like that's what I was doing. Like I wasn't really focused on making it look like a Turner or a Velasquez or a whatever. It was just I'm going to execute this portrait, based on the nature that I'm seeing in front of me, and try to be a channel for it. So it was almost like removing as much of my my own personal self as possible in order to get the realest, most kind of purest form of what I was seeing.
Interesting. Have you ever read Austin Kleon's Steal Like an Artist?
No, I haven't. I haven't. Sounds great, though.
It's a fantastic book. It's really short, but it's to the point, and he's got a bunch of little cool drawings to help bring out the points. And one of the things is you take from a bunch of different styles that you've been following for a while. So you look at the masters that have already created things. You try to create some of what they've done just on your own. Yeah. Not copying them, but like taking their style and trying to adapt it to your own.
Right.
And eventually you'll have this thing where it's your own, but it's a compilation of so many different people. It doesn't even look like anything anymore.
Right, right. What's really fascinating, actually, I saw this the other day the most clearly. One of my assistants, he's super talented, like incredibly talented. And what's interesting is I was showing him some stuff I'm working on, and then, you know, the next day he's like, hey, check this out. And he showed me like exactly the sort of focus that I was working on that was a copy. But it was, I realized that that's exactly what I had been doing for the last, you know, 10 years. I had been copying my, you know, family's art. I've been copying, you know, this other instructor's style. I've been copying. And the copy is sort of like a form of understanding. You know, it'd be like speaking in the way that someone else speaks, which we all do the exact same thing. It's like, if you ever have siblings, you ever notice how they all have similar gestures. So I notice those things always happen. And I think that, like you said, you know, being able to understand and copy different places is so important. For me, the real magic happened when I could compare and contrast two very different voices. So learning one language very clearly, learning another language very clearly, and then comparing and contrasting in between. And that's when I felt like I had the most freedom to, you know, implement in a way that was with purpose rather than with do this way because I say so, that kind of vibe. So it's been really interesting kind of getting to the point where you can start, you know, splicing the DNA of kind of what you're doing versus just like compare, like, you know, taking, you know, piece and be like, yeah, we're going to use, you know, an arm of this, you know, goat and then a body of this ape or something. It's like you can tell when it's really coming from a source versus when it's just being kind of annexed.
Yeah, it's like pulling from all the different inspiration and letting what you've learned create something entirely new.
Yeah. It's always fun though.
Yeah. What kind of lessons did you learn while you were away from art for those years?
Yeah. You know, I have to say it was a really, how do you describe it? Going from growing up with an identity as I'm an artist, I come from a family of artists, to going into the business world and being like, I'm producing a result. This result has nothing to do with my identity. Was a really powerful experience because it sort of, it made me realize that, you know, I'm not an artist. I'm not a search engine marketer. I'm not a XYZ. What I really am is just someone who tends to be more creative when they produce something. Someone who tends to be, you know, have a certain trajectory when, you know, presented with a certain problem or challenge or, you know, inspired to create something a certain way. So it was really nice. It kind of took away the kind of snowflake-ism and it made it more about, a more practical, easily like assumed kind of role of being like, yeah, let's do this. This is totally possible. I don't need necessarily credentials. Skill is always required to do something at different levels, but it wasn't about kind of identifying with a certain role. So it's much more free, actually.
Huh. That's an interesting observation because normally you don't think of leaving the arts and becoming more freed, right?
Right. Well, I guess what's interesting is, I mean, I would say some people, you know, they grow up and And I'm speaking about, you know, exact certain friends of mine who are like, you know, I just have to do this because my parents really want me to. And I mean, I can actually say that's very similar in my life, where it's like, I had every opportunity, but it was one of those things where it's presented so early that you're not really sure if you chose it or not, or it chose you. But what was really, really amazing and coming to terms with was coming back to it with that sense of freedom, knowing that you can choose, and then kind of, you know, going full force again. And that, to me, that's like the reason why I'm so excited about where the moment, kind of where I'm at right now.
Right. I think one of those things that we do too often is work with the labels that are given or received, right? So I'm an artist, but what does that really mean? It's like, sure, you can do whatever you want to do at the moment. You don't have to be label yourself as an artist. You're just creating something.
Yeah, right, right. And I think we're all creative to a large degree. It's just a matter of, like, you know, what medium you choose to kind of invest that in.
Yeah, so you can be a chef and be creative. You can be, I don't know, a lamp maker and turn it into a creative endeavor. Like, anything,
yeah,
can use creative elements.
Sure. You could be an accountant and be, you know, ultra creative as well.
Mm-hmm.
People pay a lot of money for that, for people to be, you know, very creative. But yeah, I think it can be channeled into anything. I think it's human nature to be creative, and you know, there's just different mediums to do that in.
Yeah, it's I think a problem with the way some people view creativity is the fact that they think only artists can do it, but
yeah,
creativity is pulled from every wake of life. It's essentially living.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I'll add to that as well, because I think there's a lot of, you know, fun stigmas attached to, you know, the label of artist. And I think if you're really, really pushing your art in a way that is, I just think if you're really going hard to make something with full intention, it's not so much like you're in total bliss the whole time and it's wonderful and you're like, this is great, I'm an artist, I don't care about anything, and it's just happening. Like, I definitely don't subscribe to that, but I do feel like it's probably some of the hardest work that somebody can do, but also the most rewarding and fulfilling. And I think if you're really pushing it, you can get that huge sense of satisfaction. But at the same time, you know, it requires a lot of work, both in preparing and then also when you execute.
Yeah, the people often say, or they've been realizing, that their journey is greater than the outcome. So
sure,
even something like going on vacation, if you have that anticipation going up to it, you're like, it makes it much better experience. Even though the vacation might be fun, the anticipation of it builds that experience.
Yeah, yeah, living into the future. Yeah. Cool.
So, can you talk about the moment you realized you wanted to go back into art?
Yeah. It was sort of like a seed growing. It wasn't like a snap call where it's like, all right, today. But I would say, you know, when I was working in startups, I would, you know, be you know, shooting for, like, oh, we're gonna get the millionth download of the mobile app, you know, it's gonna be awesome. And then, or like, oh, we're gonna shave off another 30 cents per click on our $1 million AdWords account and, you know, make the company, you know, $150,000 more a month or something like that. And at first it was super exciting, super gratifying, because they're extremely concrete goals and challenges and problems to handle. But at a certain point, there was people who could do it, and people were very good at it. And I felt like my interests lied more in, you know, what can I do to make something that inspires other people? And I realized from getting distance away from art that art was something that always inspired others. And I had never really just seen that for what it was, because I was always so close to it that I was just used to people being like, I love that, or that's so cool. And I would not, it wouldn't register with me But then I was like, it really made a difference one day. And then, you know, funny things like my a family member of mine introduced me to Chuck Close, who's, you know, this famous painter. He's been around forever. And, you know, they suggested I show him my portraits from when I was a kid. And I showed him my work, and he was like, you know, he's a quadriplegic, so he's been in a wheelchair for like 30 years. And he's like, you know, if you don't start painting again, I'm going to kick your ass. And I was like, oh, okay, great. Thanks. You know, I appreciate that. And, you know, a year and a half later, I had a show in New York. So it's sort of like, it just started growing and growing and growing. I guess the courage to start doing it again, because it requires courage to just like kind of face that expectation of, you know, your past or what others might think or all that stuff. But yeah, it just kind of kept growing, and now it's sort of like got some momentum behind it. It's really exciting.
Have you hit any major obstacles on your way towards being the artist that you want to be?
Interesting. I suppose there's obstacles every day, and it's really just how you kind of approach those as problems. You kind of want to be like water, you know, you kind of want to be like, you know, water, you know, over the log or water under the log, or, you know, kind of assume different shapes in order to get past each one of those blocks. And I suppose, it's literally like running your own business. And creativity is a portion of it that is just as important as, you know, kind of like having the right people around you and supporting the group and all those things too. So I kind of see it as like, that's just the way it is.
So you will face those obstacles. So when they come, they're not so daunting, and then you can overcome them, as opposed to, you know, oh, how am I supposed to do this? I'm just going to curl up into a ball and try in the corner.
Right. You know, there's times to curl up in a ball for, you know, a little bit, but I would say, yeah, it's all expected. I mean, that's what kind of life is just, you know, what level of the game are you playing at? And always kind of just coming back to like, okay, what level am I at right now? And I would say that's the hardest part. I think art tends to make it easy to have sort of visions, you know, like this is what I want things to be like. And then you paint a painting and it kind of looks like that. So it's almost like you try to do that in life as well. And I would say one of the biggest challenges is just coming back to the here and now and be like, okay, what are things like right now? And if I were to choose the way things were right now in like, you know, the good, the bad, the ugly, what's my next move? And I would say that's the master skill to keep kind of growing and moving in the direction that you want, and not really regressing, because you learn at the level you're at, and then those lessons prevent you from kind of backstepping too far. So that's the way I feel about hurdles and challenges and things like that. And doing the art is really just a privilege. I mean, that's the sort of icing on the cake of the whole situation.
You know, the interesting thing about obstacles and being afraid of things, it comes to everybody. So I don't know if you've been paying attention to Kanye West and all the stuff that's going on with his album release, but, you know, he is facing a whole different level of challenges than he would have been even like 5 years ago.
Yeah, definitely. It's actually interesting you mentioned Kanye West, because he had one of my absolute favorite quotes, which I don't know why I was so fascinated by it, but it was in the Daft Punk documentary, which is called like Releasing Punk or something like that. They interview him, and he said, you know, most artists, when they find their voice, it ends up, sometimes it creates a massive amount of wealth and material objects in their life. And then he said, but the same artists tend to try to hold on to those objects, and they tend to lose their voice because of that. And I thought that was like really just a very interesting kind of like on the way up, on the way down kind of commentary. And I was just kind of shocked to hear it from him, but it was pretty great.
It's sometimes hard to distinguish between the artist and the person when dealing with Kanye, because it's like, which part of him is, you know, the thing that is promoting, and which part is, you know, him.
Right. Yeah. I think that's actually another sort of, I think, unique topic to the arts is, you know, representation versus, you know, the creative, you know, persona in the equation. And I think that sort of trinity between, you know, business, aka buyers, and the artist and the, let's call them an agent or kind of in between. That's a very interesting relationship that's also, I think, important to have in the arts as well. So trust is a huge, probably the single biggest challenge as well, is like, you know, building those relationships that can really support one another.
Can you talk about some of those relationships that you have built as an artist?
Sure. I suppose, you know, I guess having like a, it kind of goes two ways, right? It's like you can treat your kind of social network in a way that kind of garners more support by supporting them in the ways that are meaningful. And then you can also just surround yourself with people who are the type of people who will be really supportive of you in different ways. So I don't know. I kind of see it as like you can be kind of. This is just general life advice, and I'm not one to give too much advice, but it's really just getting around the right people for you is that'll change everything. You know, just knowing one person who's, you know, excited about what you're doing, and you guys have like a, you know, a nice camaraderie, that's really powerful. Whereas knowing 100 people who are in some other category may not be.
It's the Jim Rohn quote. It's like, surround yourself with the people that you want to be here. Yeah. You are the summary of the 5 people you spend the most time with.
Yeah, entirely. I mean, just go cruise the self-help section of any bookstore, and you'll find, you know, all the exact advice that, you know, everyone should listen to, and definitely the social ones are really important too. You know?
I think the interesting thing is people have been doing this for thousands of years, and yet we're still having the same problems that those people had when, you know, they didn't have what we have.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think also too, you know, as someone gets better just in their own life, you know, the relationship with themselves and things like that, that, you know, the people around them kind of also get better. So I think there's a number of different ways to kind of look at it, but I think, you know, wherever the person is at, that's the type of friends they're going to have. So that's, I kind of feel that way. Like my development over the last 10 years, like the friends I had 10 years ago, you know, some I still have from those kind of groups, but the type of friends that I have now, it's just different, you know?
Yeah. It's the, every stage of life changes who you are and who you're surrounded by. And that's just life. It's not good or bad. It's just what happens.
Yeah, definitely.
When you got back into art, did you immediately go to New York? Or how did that transition work?
I was still working in the startup world in San Francisco, and I kind of made a decision that I was going to make a move back to New York. And I wasn't in a place where I was going to just jump straight into art. So I made the move back to New York and continued working as a software engineer for a bit, and then decided, you know, it was just time to kind of, you know, spread my wings and go full-time artist. So I would say that's the trajectory. It was kind of like a countdown, but it was like all the while kind of building up the platform, the boilerplate of the business to be able to kind of support myself.
What kinds of things did you set up for yourself in order to make that transition?
One basic one is just a really great representation of the work, you know, like great photos, clean website, being able to articulate a story that others could understand easily if they never heard of me. I would say those are kind of the basis. And then just, you know, making friends in the art world, being like, you know, what's it about? What are people up to? Things like that. Put together a show in Brooklyn, which was really fun. It was a group show, and I got invited to co-curate it. It was like 6,500 square foot, like warehouse space, like 100-foot ceilings. And it was great. We had 20 artists, like 30 paintings, and like we lit it all. It was nice. Like, it was just like a very great, like kind of edgy, artsy kind of event. And yeah, it was super fun. We had like a lot of people there, probably like 800 people over the course of like two nights. And yeah, so a show like that was sort of like the first foray into being able to show work. And I was like, wow, I really like this. I kind of want to do this again. So just followed the path to be able to do that again.
What were your feelings during that particular moment in your career? Was it something where you knew that you were going to continue to do this, or were you still doubtful? Or
no, I was pretty pretty certain that was like a path that I was like, this is great, I love this, and I just wanted to do it again. Like, I love sharing work with people, and I love creating kind of new things and being that kind of event where others can kind of check it out and be like, wow, that's crazy. How'd you do that? Or, wow, that's interesting. Like, what's it about? For me, that was the most exciting part. So I saw it more as an opportunity to continue doing something that was very fulfilling. And then, you know, getting the finances and all that stuff to work out, you know, you can't really plan that, but you can prepare to try to make that work. So that was the sort of next step, is being, you know, not having a show in Brooklyn, but having a show in Manhattan, you know, where it's more easy for people, you know, to kind of show up at the show who might enjoy buying the work more so. So that's kind of the way I thought about it.
You mentioned that you had really nice photos and a story to accompany your art. Can you talk about the importance of each of those and why you think artists should have that quality of work and something behind it?
Right. You mentioned, yeah, sorry, you said story and images. Is that right?
Yeah, like high quality images, not like crappy small cell phone photos.
Basically, just presenting the work in the best way possible is one of the I think the highest leverage things you can do. And then on top of that, the kind of the other single most important thing is just having a really clear story that others can be like, oh yeah, I get it, like, or wow, I really don't resonate with this artist at all. Like, having that polarization between the two different different visitors, I think, is important. And everyone has their own story, everyone has their, you know, very unique, distinct background, and I think it can be just hugely interesting and informative of how the work kind of came to be, because we're all, you know, pretty unique individuals. So it's only fair to be able to describe, you know, the work that you make is, you know, having some type of context, which is your life.
Have you noticed anybody react well to the story that you tell and the difference that they have of how they perceive the art once they know how you created or the story behind it?
I think with the work that I'm doing now, I like the sort of creating that curiosity behind the work. So it's kind of like, what do you see? You know, so the Rorschach tests. And I think that inspires a lot of questions about, you know, the work, and actually, like, for me, it inspires a lot of questions on what other people think. And yeah, so that's sort of the, I think the background, I think people want to know about the artist, and then when they know about the artist, then they can kind of choose to interact with the work more easily. So I kind of see it as more like a rapport thing, story. But I think there's always room to like make it more more direct, more interesting, and more moving for the viewer to be like, wow, it's amazing. You know, that's amazing. Their story is so unique, and then be able to kind of see that in the work and be like, oh, I see they're kind of making work that, you know, resonates with a certain portion of their life or something like that. I think those things are super important. I've seen like a lot of different responses to my own story and my own work. So I don't really have like a one set solution on that.
Mm-hmm. I think when you have that personal connection with people, it makes it much easier for them to be able to buy it or justify themselves buying it, even though it doesn't really make the work any different, but it makes it different in their mind.
Yeah. It's funny. I actually just today I saw something when I was looking for reference online, and I saw this this painting. It was like just like swirls and swirls and swirls of brown, like something that like a 5-year-old might do, is just like mash paint around to a circle. And but then what was interesting was that I saw an image of Alice in Wonderland next to it, and I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. That's like Alice falling down the rabbit hole. And for me, they had staged, you know, the meaning of the work in that situation. And I think that's what the story tends to do, is stage the meaning of what people can, you know, kind of bring to the work in terms of their own intricacies of what that meaning would be. I think, you know, contemporary art has a different levels of walls of entry, where you're like, oh yeah, I totally get that, you know, on first sight. Or you'll be like, this one is very, very tall wall. I need to just read a little bit about it or understand it on a different level, and then you can appreciate it. So I think those things are probably some of the most important things to consider in terms of work, depending on what type of work you do. I mean, you may do just, you know, beautiful little landscapes, and those really don't need much explanation. They're just, you know, observations of nature. But if you're doing, you know, sheep and formaldehyde, you know, maybe that's a different approach.
So. I think
equally valid, I would say, depending on the audience, you know. So. Mm-hmm.
Everyone goes through life in such a different way that you can pull an infinite number of meanings from a single piece of work, and none of those are wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I honestly think, like, you know, life is very much a cosmic joke, and you know, the ironies in life, and just the like you said, so many different ways to evaluate something's meaning, that in a certain sense it's sort of meaningless, and then it's kind of liberating because you can kind of choose the meaning that you want at the end of the day, you know, if you want to go to that level. But yeah, I don't know. I think it makes it more exciting when you can kind of choose your meaning. And I think that's kind of the what the creative kind of artist has the power to do sometimes, is kind of like set the stage for that in a way that people can either choose to participate or just, you know, or just observe and say, you know, cool. You know, maybe something else.
It reminds me of those choose your own adventure books where you can come up with different outcomes, but
yeah.
In this scenario, there are many more than, you know, the finite number that you can fit in a 300-page book.
Right. Yeah, I miss those books.
Someone should bring those back.
Yeah, definitely.
Can you talk about your latest exhibit in the Guy Hepner Gallery?
Yeah, sure. So I was part of a group show. I believe it was 7 artists, and I had 4 pieces in the show, 3 5x5 foot, and then 1 4x4 foot. And they were all these Rorschachs, so symmetrical, like hyper colorful, kind of just very, very elaborate different shape patterns. I was so happy with everything about the show, the turnout, presentation that we set up, the people I worked with, the curators. So everything kind of like really just landed right. And I was really happy to see we had a huge turnout. Like all of my different former colleagues and friends and family, and just the whole congregation of the types of people that you want to support you at a show kind of came out. So it was a really, really exciting event. And the other artists' work were very very, like, we had a good mix. It was very dynamic. So that really was exciting too, to kind of be in a space where there's all different kinds of artists too. Yeah. So that was the event.
Awesome. Speaking of the Rorschach, you told me the last time we spoke that you were you had to create a painting in, a few hours before the show. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So before the, a day before the show, we were setting up all the pieces, and it just so turned out that we set up 2 of the pieces, and then they requested, they said, listen, they look really great 5x5. If we had 3 5x5s, that would be like amazing. So can you like have the whole wall and you can get your third 5x5? And I said, okay. And then like it went right to the art store, but all the supplies I needed, and just basically got right to it, and invited my cousin, actually came over, and she helped me build the stretcher bars behind the canvas, and basically just went full on, and I made a piece that night. Next morning it was dry, and then I actually had that was the whole process. Yeah, so she helped me with a portion of it. Woke up the next morning, stretched the canvas, and then carried it to the gallery that afternoon. And I normally don't make paintings. I would say the painting, still took the same amount of time that all the other paintings took, where I spent like, half the night making it. But it was just really exciting knowing that, the previous 32 years of my life made it possible where I can, produce that result in a very condensed portion of time and still have it, hold up to the other quality of the pieces. So that was kind of the mission impossible of the day, I would say. Yeah.
When I first heard that, I was shocked that you were able to make something in that short of a notice, but then you realize that everything you've done up until now has led you to be able to do that.
Yeah. I'm really a kind of a proponent of, in the past I've spent 3.5 months making a pencil drawing, and I'm not really sure the value of that, today, but back then it was like a benchmark in my development as an artist. And then now I can do things that are, almost similar quality in, 1/10 the time. So it's just kind of like an exercise, or just pushing your mind to the point where you can see, you know how far away you are from the end result, and then it's much easier to kind of just go straight there because you can predict what's going to happen.
There was an interesting story about Picasso where a woman approached him to make a drawing for her, and he took out a napkin and made the little drawing. It took him maybe a couple of seconds, maybe a couple of minutes, and he asked her for $5,000. And she's like, "What? It took you 3 seconds or whatever?" And he's like, no, it took me an entire lifetime to be able to do that.
Yeah. My grandfather used to say that all the time with his figure drawings as well. He's like, this took me, you know, an hour of my life, but it actually took me my entire life to be able to do that in an hour.
I just, often people think, when they think of art, they're like, oh, it only took you a few hours to make, why are you charging $10,000 for it? But if it took you your entire life to be able to do that, then you're getting just a little bit back of what you put into it.
Right. Yeah.
So it takes like dedication and hard work in order to be the type of artist that can command that type of, you know, money to get what they're worth.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that also in terms of, you mentioned like, you know, hard work and discipline. The concept of 10,000 hours to achieve mastery. And I think I tallied up my hours once. It was like 12,500 hours or something. So, I think I'm a little bit slower of a learner than most. So it kind of made sense. But looking at that and then being able to, show someone like, okay, I've done something really, really academic. You can see that. And then being able to kind of like move into the foray of abstract art, it's sort of like a badge of credibility where people are like, oh wait, but you can do that, but you're doing this. A child can do that. And then you realize like, well, a child really couldn't do that, but if you look at it like from a mature standpoint, like it's much easier to see. You can kind of see like the maturity within the abstraction. Like I don't know if others can sense this or not, but like whenever I go to a museum or I go to like art shows or anything, I can always kind of tell where the artist is at by seeing an abstract work. It's very easy to do. I'm not sure if it's like an energetic thing or I don't know what it is, but I've always noticed that it's very, very easy for me to recognize kind of like how far someone has pushed their sort of training to be able to do, you know, whatever it is they're doing. So yeah. I kind of see that as something, but in terms of commanding different prices and things like that, I think it has very little to do with, you know, whether someone has training or not. But you know, the quality of the work is always going to speak for itself. And I think the advocacy who's advertising it is going to also bring a lot of worth to it as well. So, you know, a show in Soho is going to have a lot more advocacy than a show that's not in Soho. So
I think the thing is that your art is worth whatever somebody is willing to pay for it.
Right. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I guess, you know, it's an intangible thing, and I think enjoyment in art is also an intangible thing. So it's like if a piece gives you, like, you know, more enjoyment than, you know, you can, it just depends, you know, which is worth it to you. It's like, for instance, my parents, like, they have pieces, you know, from my grandfather that they're like, we'll never, ever, there's nothing that will ever cause us to sell these. And also they're like, oh my God, I can't believe, you know, someone out there has this piece because we really, really want it. And then they'll go and buy pieces back from people who have had the pieces for like 30 years. Wow. So, I mean, if that's not like, you know, a kind of badge of what, you know, the art means to them, it's like, it just seems really incredible sometimes.
Yeah. It's, you put meaning into the art yourself. Who's to say what a piece of art is worth?
Yeah. And also, I mean, like, money is kind of the same thing, where money is sort of like a consensus where we all just look at it and say, oh yeah, money is worth this much. Like, we both agree on it. So, you know, I can exchange a few dollars for, you know, a lunch or something. But, you know, art, I think art is the same way, you know, anything really.
Uh-huh. Can you talk about some of the things that you do to get your work out there on the marketing side, because you have experience in the, you know, the other side. So how do you use that in what you do with your art?
Yeah, of course. It's very, I guess it's, within art, I kind of see it as just a sharing market. So you share your work with people or an audience, and then, people respond to it or they don't. And I think, something that's worked out really well for me is Instagram. Started a fresh account maybe 10, 11 weeks ago, and it's just been growing and growing, and people have given me, really positive responses to all the different, imagery and kind of diary of development and things like that. So that's been really fun just to have a strong platform where I can interact with people using technology. So it kind of reminds me of the days when I would do software engineering, do a product release, see how, the audience was using it with all kinds of analytic tools, and kind of make adjustments to help them do what they need to do better. And in this case, it's obviously it's way more kind of pleasure oriented and way more, I would say personally, just enjoyable and fun. But yeah, it's been really, really great. That's been definitely my go-to.
How did you build up your following? Are you using hashtags, or did you tell people to follow? And how did you build up that following?
In the beginning, I would just go out and support other people. So I found people's work who I really enjoyed and appreciated, and I would just say, "Hey, I really like your stuff. Just start an account." And then, they would follow, and then they would say thanks and tag me, and other people would see that. So that's been, I would say, the most basic level. Then there's friends, my general just friend circuit. So they've been really supportive, and I went over to the Pen and Brush Museum, or not museum, Foundation Gallery, and then they have some show where they're like takeover. So draw on the walls and do some sort of stuff, do whatever you want. And I thought, oh, cool. I'll just make a little drawing. Made a little drawing, and then they're like, oh my God, we love it. And they take a photo and tag it. And then all their followers just jump on board. So it's just cool. It's just kind of people who respond to or appreciate art are kind of everywhere. So it's kind of been fun.
Yeah. So it's more about relationships than it is really trying to do something very specific to build your audience.
Yeah, I mean, in the marketing world, it's about solving problems. But like we said, with art, it's really just, what's the perception of the value of the piece, and how much pleasure does it give someone? And that's, if you're in that business, it's really just about sharing. It's a great relationship. It's in a great relationship, you don't look for what you can get and they get something from you. It's you're both in a great place, and then you want to share with one another, the kind of surplus that you have together. So I kind of feel like that's the case.
What are your plans for the future of what you want to do with your art? Are you done with the Rorschach? I know you said you wanted to do some murals.
Yeah. So really for me, 2016, the two big games that I'm playing, one of them is I want to have a huge one-man show with all the Rorschachs. I think it'd be really exciting to just walk into a space and see all these sort of psychological representations that are in every permutation of color and texture, and mostly the same size would be really cool. So I sort of see that vision. I'm excited about that. But that would be later in the year, I think, because I still have a few more I'd like to produce. And then the other game is really doing murals. So I don't talk too much about it, but sort of in the process of presenting a few different murals around the Soho area. So I really would love the sort of public stage, international audiences, because people come visit New York, they go to Soho, and they're there. So I'm really, really excited about that too. And the mural work will be definitely a departure from the Rorschachs, different medium, different scale. and also different audience. So I'm kind of excited about that too, is just to have that kind of like fresh outlet and really just working that out right now. So kind of, I guess the possibilities are endless, which is the challenge, right? Somebody said, you know, black and white has to look like something like, you know, on a face, it'd be like, oh, done, easy. But the fact that you can do anything is exciting and also, you know, kind of requires some judicial, you know, editing.
Yeah, one of the keys to creativity that people use is the ability to, you know, narrow things down, limit your possibilities, because if you don't, the world is infinite, and like you can just get stuck in all the options that you have.
Yeah, definitely. I like to think of you know, creativity, as, you know, if you meet someone and you present them with the concept of letter A and letter B, which are really just concepts, and then the creative person's like, huh. And they can find like a spectrum of combinations between the concept of A and B, whether that's like a monogram or et cetera, or different fonts or like any of that sort of differences. But then when you go back to like the concepts you kind of look at in a different way again. You're like, oh, concept A, concept B, there's two separate divided things. But sometimes being creative, you can take very few things and make lots of different permutations. Which, like we just said, it can be very, very complicated. And I think what's really cool is that the sort of financial limitations, or I should say the economy of, you know, resources that you have, is really the thing that sort of drives a lot of the creativity too. Like if you only have, you know, $50, you'll probably just do something hand painted, right? But if you have, you know, $1,000, you might really ramp it up and use some sort of special things, or hire people, or whatever it is. So, I kind of see it as that as well.
What is it about the public stage of a mural that entices you to create one?
You know, I guess my purpose in life is just share work with people and make that work. You know, have the intention to make work that inspires others. And more specifically, you know, if people look at the work and they feel like, you know, their potential in life is a little bit higher than they imagined before, then it's all worth it. So that's the thing that gets me up in the morning to do what I do.
Yeah. One thing I like to think of is the power to motivate even just one person into doing something that they wouldn't have done otherwise. That is the power of art. Even if you can affect one person, that it was worth creating, right?
Yeah, definitely. I think one of the other, you know, pieces is, you know, having a very big space to move into. So, you know, if you want to, you know, have a like, hey, I want to make a mural that's colorful and people will follow me on Instagram. It's like the amount of energy you're going to put into that is going to be significantly smaller than, you know, if you're like, listen, I really want to make something that's like powerful, impactful, you know, changes the world. Then it's going to be, you're going to be playing in a very different playing field, and, you know, people are going to want to join in rather than the other one, which is like people just kind of get bummed out and they're like, well, you know, I don't really know what this is about. So,
gotcha. I have a couple more questions left. What is your favorite quote?
Favorite quote is by Matisse and is, creativity takes courage.
What is it about that quote that speaks to you?
When I started the pieces, when I started the Rorschachs after not doing art for 5 years, you know, just getting a bottle of ink and making Rorschachs on napkins was terrifying to me. Like it was just like paralyzing. And just that little bit of courage to kind of move forwards, just created a confidence and excitement and resiliency that I never would have had otherwise. So for me, doing something I'm a little bit scared of every day is sort of a mantra as well. And there's nothing else that gives me like a greater sense of freedom.
Hmm. What would you recommend to somebody that wants to do something creative, but they're paralyzed by that fear that you had?
I'd make a plan, and the plan starts with, you know, why you want to do something, what you're going to do, how you're going to do it, and then the very next action.
Yeah, so take the small step necessary in a long set of steps to eventually accomplish what you want to do.
Yeah, and you know, till this day, that's something that, you know, I continually have to, you know, I would say trick myself into, is that sometimes you're like, oh my God, I have this vision, it's going to be impossible to achieve. And then I'll just trick myself and say, well, I'm not going to expect anything. I'm just going to go and do work. And then 9 times out of 10, it ends up being so different from what I intended to do, just out of the mere fact of just being there and being present. So that's what I mean by having your very next action. Like, it literally would be like, stand up, walk over to desk, and then next action. Yeah, next action is, you know, pick up pencil, make first mark on paper. And once you do that, then you're in it. You know, you don't have to have any more actions after that. You're in it to win it.
Yeah, it's like thinking of doing a marathon, but, you know, when you think about that as a long 20 whatever miles it is, it's possible at this point if you've done nothing. But if you say start with a couple of steps and then you build on top of that, you'll eventually get to the point where you can do it.
Yeah, you don't need to start running either. This is like a intramurals marathon. It's not, yeah.
it's a long game. It's not, you know, a sprint.
yeah, absolutely.
Do you have a morning routine? And if you do, what is it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, brush my teeth, eat breakfast, and then actually, you know what? I would say I have a night routine that sets me up for the next day. So that's way more important. So, you know, every night I'll write down, you know, what's my goal? It's like, you know, I want to, you know, achieve X, Y, Z, and then I'll make a list of, we'll keep it super simple. What I do is I'll, before I go to bed every night, what I'll do is I'll just map out my next day best I can. So I'll be like, wake up 8 a.m. or wake up 6 a.m. or wake up whatever. And then I'll write down, like, you know, brush teeth, eat breakfast, and then like start on this X drawing and then implement, you know, this. So just basically make a huge list and then include my afternoon and my night and all that. So when I do that, it sort of like primes my brain for the next day, to the point where I don't feel like I'm like dragging my feet to do anything. It's just things are just firing and they're in relative, you know, sequence. And, you know, I usually get to 80% of it, which is, you know, I think pretty good. So.
Mm-hmm. There's a limit to the amount of willpower we have in a day. So if you set yourself up to be able to do a bunch of different habits in a row, the amount of thought it takes to do each of those is lessened if you prepare to do it before.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I've done a huge amount of study and practice on those as well. And doing the actions the night before, it's like it just pre-programs my mind to just be way more receptive to getting the stuff I want to get done. But yeah, the willpower thing is very interesting as well.
Do you have any book, podcast, or documentary recommendations?
I guess just one that just stands out, just because we mentioned it before, was the Daft Punk Unchained. It was just it's just really cool to see two people who are kind of like uncompromising in their artistic direction and quality, and then who also maintained the like integrity of their own personal lives. And I thought that was just a very interesting documentary.
And they're masked the entire time, I'm assuming.
Yeah, I mean, actually, most of it is interviews about everyone around, like around them. So, which is, you know, how I guess really, really solid documentaries go. But yeah, it's pretty good. And then let's see, there's a book. You know, I took a speed reading class, and then I read like every book possible and on all different topics I was super curious about. And then after a while, I just stopped reading because they seemed like it was repeating in a lot of places. So not to say there aren't amazing books out there, but trying to think of one that would be relevant to the arts. Maybe for anyone who like wants to like continue being creative, but maybe a little more challenging, is The Art of War, which I think you mentioned to me also. Yeah,
The War of Art.
The War of Art. Excuse me. The War of Art.
Because the other one is by Sun Tzu, written in.
Thank you.
Thoroughly.
Thank you for that clarification. Yeah, I'm not proposing a strategic war talk. Yeah, no.
Although that could be helpful in the way that you approach business or art, because there are principles you can take from that, but that's not what you were talking about.
Right. Correct. Yeah. So, anyways, it's a nice one to just like. It's kind of just nice food for thought as you move through the creative cycles, and all the things that describe are very real, kind of like intangible, unspoken things that most artists go through as they create things. So it's kind of a nice expose on that.
Yeah, that's definitely a good one. Who is somebody you know personally that is extremely creative, and then somebody you don't know personally that is also creative?
Let's see, personally creative. So a friend of mine who's a very successful entrepreneur, he has a company called Connect, and he's probably one of the smartest people I know, hardest working people I know, but he's also like extremely funny and charismatic, and like comes up with stand-up comedy jokes all the time and stuff. So, he's definitely one of the people I know who's most creative. And then someone who I don't know who I think is ultra creative. Is that right? Let's see here. Creative. I guess. Yeah, I suppose some of the, maybe, I don't know why I'm thinking this, but like some of the DJs out there who come up with like very elaborate orchestrations of music, and the music is just, you've never heard, you've heard pieces of it before, but it's synthesized in a way that's sort of new combinations. And I think a lot of those are really cool. Or Guy Ritchie, the director. I think he adds a level of creativity to his work, infused with commercialism, that I think is really powerful too. I'm thinking of a specific scene too, which is
any scene from Snatch, right?
Yeah. I'm actually thinking of the scene in Snatch where the guy gets uppercutted, and then when he hits the ground, they switch to an image of that same guy falling into water. So you see him underwater, just get like literally just consumed by it. And then that's like this, like, dreamlike metaphor for what actually happened. And I think something like that is just amazing, because he's describing mood with like ultra visuals. It's very cool.
Awesome. Those are good. I never thought of the DJ one, but that is definitely essentially the definition of creativity, because you're mashing up a bunch of stuff together.
Right. Yeah. And yeah, I think so. I definitely think so.
What is your definition of creativity, and what can people do to be more creative?
Definition of creativity right now is just be able to synthesize things together. So, to maybe synthesize things together to make the sum greater than the parts. And things that help people be more creative. make a mess, like AKA, you know, taking red and taking blue and seeing what happens when you mix the two. Like, you know, painting is just like a perfect medium for that. And just letting themselves make a disaster of, you know, tons of failures. And I'm using terminology that that side of the brain would typically call it. So yeah, I would just, yeah, go out there and just make a mess. Like, take one of those like wine painting classes or something. I think all those things are kind of like, that's kind of like drawing and painting for adults. Like, for instance, I'll see my two nieces and they'll be like wild and crazy all over the place, like breaking things, terrorizing everyone. and then my mom will come out and be like, come on, come on, and like bring them into the studio and then just set them up to do little paintings on teacups. And like, you can't hear them. And they're like so focused and quiet and playing nice with one another. It's just like, it's just kind of incredible. The sort of positives that come from like focused attention on something to create something. So yeah. So maybe paint teapots. I don't know. Something like that.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, Max, this has been really cool talking to you. I think artists and non-artists too can learn a lot from the stuff that you have to say, especially since you've gone on both sides of the artistic spectrum. Is there a challenge that you would like to set out for the audience who is listening?
Well, thanks for having me, first of all. A challenge, a throwdown. let's see, that's a great question. I wonder, I would say the first person to create a Rorschach and send it to me on Instagram, I think. That's a challenge. That would force somebody to be creative, and there's no limits to what they could possibly do. So I think that would be cool.
Awesome.
That would be my challenge for someone to unlock their creativity to do that. That'd be it.
Sweet. Well, yeah, it's been really cool talking to you. I look forward to talking again. Is there a way that people can keep up to date with what you're doing?
Yeah. So like we mentioned before, Instagram is the go-to, and my handle for that is Max Makewell. So exactly as it sounds. So it's M-A-X and then M-A-K-E-W-E-L-L. And, yeah, just follow me there and I'll have all kinds of new art and projects, and I'll be asking for people's opinions and stuff on different things that I might be making or might not be making. So it's a fun little, it's like a party room, I guess. but yeah, that's
very cool.
Awesome. Thanks again. I really appreciate it. And it's always fun kind of sharing what's going on behind the sharing.
Awesome. Well, take care.
All right. Thanks. See you, Kevin.
All right. Bye.
And that's it for the 43rd episode of Cracking Creativity. For show notes, go to crackingcreativity.org/43. If you like this episode, subscribe to the show on iTunes at crackingcreativity.org/subscribe. Also, feel free to write a review or leave me a comment about the show. Hope this stoked your creative fires, and I'll see you next time on Cracking Creativity.